I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Eric Fair was a military contractor in Iraq in the first year of the war, working as an interrogator at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison and at a detention facility in Fallujah. He has been haunted and racked with guilt ever since. He says he engaged in torture with some of the prisoners he interrogated, and he witnessed and heard the mistreatment of prisoners that was first exposed in 2004. The use of sleep deprivation, threats, violence, nudity, and stress positions, including something called the Palestinian chair. He wrote about what he saw and did in a series of op-eds and essays, and now he's written a memoir. It's titled Consequence. He was on Radio Times back in 2008 when he was a first-year student at Princeton Theological Seminary. And Eric Fair joins us once again on Radio Times. And nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with a quote that you have from Maimonides. In the very beginning of your book, you write, "For example, a person is not forgiven until he pays back his fellow man what he owes him and appeases him. He must placate him and approach him again and again until he is forgiven." This is from the Laws of Repentance. You have been writing about this for about 10 years now.
Yeah, it's interesting when I speak publicly in front of groups, or even often if I have a conversation with a friend, one of the questions that will come up is, you know, why are we talking about this now, or why am I writing about this now? And I have been doing this for 10 years.
Yes, but
some of the original op-eds that were local to the Morning Call up in the Lehigh Valley, as well as the Inquirer, were written in 2006. And even the Washington Post piece, which eventually published in February 2007, I had started writing in 2006. So it's been a long journey for me, but I think also for the country. It's not an issue that has gone away with the publication of the photographs from Abu Ghraib. It continues to be sort of a front page story that the nation continues to debate.
Do you feel by writing and in a sense confessing, because much of what you've been writing about is confessing what you did, that you will be forgiven, that you are forgiven? Are you looking to forgive yourself?
Yeah, certainly the word forgiveness gets used throughout the book, and even appears in the opening statement there. But the book is not about forgiveness. It certainly is a confession, and it's certainly I'm making an effort to be as honest and as open as I can, which I think is really the only way to approach this kind of transgression, which I think is true for the nation as well. So there's certainly my story, which I've tried to be as honest about as I can, but I think the nation, with things like the release of the Senate torture report and continued open debate about the people that were involved in this program, it's something that's required of us.
Do you worry, though, that many people have moved on? They're not thinking about Abu Ghraib. They're not thinking about interrogation. They've forgotten about the Senate report. You know, we don't have troops the way we did in Iraq. We're looking at other parts of that world.
Yeah, and it was interesting. We're reinserting troops back into Iraq.
We
now,
are.
Right? Advisors. And throughout our nation's history, we often introduce advisors into different parts of the world, and that tends not to end very well. So the idea that the war in Iraq is over, I think, is simply untrue. Certainly the war in Afghanistan rages on. And I think looking at just about any regional threat, there's a good indication that we are going to go back to war. I mean, that's our history. That's really every nation's history. It may be 10, 15, 20 years. But the issue of interrogation and how we deal with prisoners of war will be something that we continue to talk about. We have Donald Trump saying waterboarding and so much worse. And we certainly focus on Donald Trump and the show that he is. But there are a large, significant portion of Americans who support what he says. It's hard to know if it's a majority. I guess we'll find out in November. But it certainly seems that there is still a very strong voice for torture.
I thought it was interesting when he said that, that some of the military higher-ups basically said, we would disobey that order.
Right, yeah.
I mean, does that give you some confidence that we might have learned something from what we did?
That addresses a couple of different issues. One is the Army. The Army is not necessarily allowed to disobey legal orders, and Donald Trump isn't suggesting that he would institute waterboarding and so much worse, and then keep it quiet. He has come out and said he would make it legal, and he would get support of the Congress, so they'd pass a law and make this stuff legal again. And if it's legal, the Army, if ordered, has an obligation to do that. So it's certainly encouraging that there are people in uniform that say that this is beneath the armed services and beneath the United States. And those voices have always been out there. But And this gets a little bit into the theme of the book. I'm not exposing something that we were trying to keep secret or that was hidden. I'm simply writing about what was policy and what we were doing, not behind closed doors, but in front of officers and supervisors. And there was no fear that we were going to be exposed. So certainly we were calling it enhanced interrogation at the time. I think most have moved on to recognize that it's torture. But going back down this path is very easy.
You say a number of interesting things in this book. One is that torture does work, but it's a question of the morality of torture, which is, of course, a whole other question.
Yeah. Well, and again, I mean, each question that we get into here opens just a can of worms, but about whether or not torture works. I think, again, human history makes it pretty clear that inflicting some kind of physical or mental pain on someone can make certain people do certain things, to include divulge information that they'd rather not. But the question of whether or not torture works should really be about a question of, is it the most effective technique in terms of speaking with prisoners of war? And clearly it is not. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that it is. And again, as I've answered in many other times, none of that matters, or at least none of that should matter, that it really is a question of morality. And maybe we do need a leader to step forward and say, look, maybe torture is effective, and maybe it would accomplish some of the goals, but we can't use it. And we as Americans have an obligation to accept some of the risks that come with holding these high ideals.
You don't think a leader has said that? Has Obama said that to your satisfaction?
Not to my satisfaction, no. And I have great respect for President Obama, and he certainly ended the program the day he took office and has struggled, I think, to close Guantanamo Bay, which I don't think is entirely on him. But I think I don't think we've had a public leader at this point who has said that there are certain risks that we assume as Americans, and that if our real goals are issues like freedom, that comes with there are certain risks associated with that. Everyone who wears the uniform recognizes that that's the case. You don't put on a uniform, whether it's as a police officer or a soldier or a Marine, and not realize that you're putting your life on the line. And I'm not suggesting that every civilian should have to face death every day, but certainly as a civilian of the United States, there are certain risks that you assume as a citizen.
You write this book in present tense, and I know that seems like a kind of shallow response, but I thought that was obviously an interesting choice on your part. It wasn't using the past tense about the things that have happened to you, but puts us as readers in the middle of your life. Was that the idea?
Yeah. I mean, there were, like any writer, I went through a number of different revisions throughout the book, and some of the original ones started in the past tense and said about the things that I had done. And maybe even tried to explain and suggest that torture was like, or Iraq was like this, or it was as if this had happened. And I recognized just kind of the impotence of that kind of language, and that the only way to do it was to just sort of put myself and also the reader right back into that situation. And it speaks to another issue, the idea that I try not to suggest that that I tortured someone in the past or that I was a torturer. That, you know, I own that. I am. I did these things, and it's not something I can simply close the book on and move forward. This is a part of who I am, and also speaking about the nation, it's a part of who we are now as a nation.
You're a Marine. You spent time in the Marine Corps.
I was a soldier, actually.
A soldier. I'm sorry. Yes, you're absolutely right. Well, you would know, wouldn't you? And then, I mean, you had some health problems.
Mm-hmm.
And was working in a police force in Lehigh Valley.
I was, yeah.
And the health problems essentially disqualified you for that job.
Yeah.
But it didn't disqualify you to be a contractor for this group, CACI CACI.
Yeah, well, whether or not it should have disqualified me is I'm not sure. But they at that time, contracting companies were not there was no physical exam that I had to go through. Post 9/11, I considered reenlisting, and I was a police officer, and so I was with that job. And then, as you said, when I lost that job because of the heart condition, the desire to stay involved in what was going on was overwhelming.
Which is why you wanted to be a contractor?
Well, contracting at that point was the only option for me to get back to Iraq as quickly as I could. I mean, again, this was late 2003. The belief, I think, at that point was that the war in Iraq was going to end very quickly, maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months, but certainly no longer than a year or two. And so the idea of even reenlisting at that point, it would have taken me a couple of months to get back into a unit and to train, and there's no way to know if I would have deployed. Contracting offered me an immediate entrance into Iraq, and so I was signed up in late December and was there by January.
In fact, no interview. I mean, basically just sign on the dotted line. And
there were a couple of phone calls just to make sure that I had paperwork in order. But no, there was no what you would think of as a job interview. There was nothing like that.
You write, as former soldiers and Marines, none of us were comfortable with the lack of planning, lack of support, and lack of proper supplies. No weapons, no communications equipment, no maps, nothing for first aid. We all expect something to go wrong very soon. And no armor as well. So basically... Yeah. Dropped in the middle of a war without any protection.
Yeah, again, Saddam Hussein had been captured in December. And so I think even when we were there in January, the feeling was, and even the rhetoric from the administration at that point, was that the war was over and that what you're dealing with was just kind of the last gasp of the insurgency. Those of us who were there obviously knew far different. It was an active war zone. IEDs were ramping up and certainly incoming rounds. But again, it was hard as a former soldier, and I assume as a former Marine, to walk away from that. And it's drilled into your head, and I think in a good way, that you make do with what you have, and you know simple things like you simply complete the mission, right? Mm-hmm. And you can continue to try to improve your equipment and whatever else that is that you have, but you have an obligation to do the job with whatever you're given.
You spoke some Arabic.
And
you were an interrogator. What was the job description? What were you told you were supposed to find out?
Well, the original job description was simply just interrogator. And I think my impression was that we'd be interrogating prisoners of war back in the rear, maybe even in a place like Kuwait. And army or military interrogation is more like a debriefing. And so the idea is that you get soldiers into your interrogation booth. And you want to find out what unit they were in and what kind of equipment they had and how high their morale was and how likely were their comrades to attack or surrender and then pass that information up to higher. But what Abu Ghraib was and what Iraq was really far more law enforcement, and the idea that we weren't even sure what the insurgency was at this point. Certainly someone like me who'd been an Arabic linguist knew Iraq's history and knew about the Sunni and the Shia, but we didn't have a good, clear indication of whether or not the Sunni and the Shia were going to work together, whether or not they'd be able to form a government, whether or not once some of the attacks started, if it was the Sunni and Shia working together against us. And so there were just unknowns. The whole place was an unknown. And so each interrogation was in many ways a law enforcement mm-hmm. interrogation.
We're almost up at a break here, but you talk about, quote unquote, getting things done. I mean, essentially that was your mission, your job, to get things done.
Yeah, the job was to get information, yes.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Eric Fair. He was a guest on Radio Times 8 years ago in 2008, talking about his time as an interrogator in Iraq. He has written a memoir. It's called Consequence, in many ways about that same story, with obviously much more detail, also writing about growing up in the Lehigh Valley and how he has struggled with what he did, what he saw when he was in Iraq. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Talking with Eric Fair. He's written a memoir called Consequence about growing up in the Lehigh Valley here in Pennsylvania. His work as a military contractor and the torture, as he says, that he was involved in and also witnessed when he was an interrogator at Abu Ghraib and also at a detention facility in Fallujah in Iraq. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Abu Ghraib, just the scale of Abu Ghraib is hard to describe.
Large place.
How large a place? How sprawling?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's any comparison to be made, but it was a number of prisons within one large complex. And Iraq is, at least that portion of Iraq is incredibly flat. And so even those of us who were in the prison, it was hard to kind of get a grasp of just how large the prison was, certainly if you saw it from the helicopter. We actually lived in one of the prisons, one of our living facilities.
In the cells,
yeah,
right?
We actually lived in a cell, and you know, you could close the doors, and the old cafeterias that were there where the prisoners would eat, and then you'd walk across the open fields to another prison complex. Now, most of the Iraqi prisoners were kept in open open-air camps, and then just a limited few were in what is now known as the hard site, which was simply just another prison building where the higher value prisoners were kept.
You described the hard site.
Yeah.
What did it look like?
You know, it's interesting.
What did you see?
The question comes up a lot, and justifiably so. And I, you know, walking into the hard site was in many ways like walking into any other prison. I'd been a police officer, so I'd been in many American prisons, county prisons. And so it looked, it was a two-tiered prison, open bay in the middle with cells along the walls. But the number of, and it was sort of, I was sort of slow to recognize as I walked in. I walked in and I saw a naked prisoner in his cell, and just seeing one, it wasn't so much of a shock as just kind of not fully understanding what was going on. And then walking a little further and seeing another one, and then another one. And then each cell that you walked by, someone was either naked or locked or handcuffed to the cell wall. And then a line of what I assumed were newly arrived prisoners, you know, being stripped naked and dragged around the floor if they weren't getting their pants off quickly enough. And it was cold. It was January, and this Iraq certainly gets hot in the summer, but cold in the winter. By the time I'd spent a good 20 minutes to a half an hour, it was a recognition that it was at least, in retrospect, probably one of the first recognitions that I was involved in something that I was going to pay a pretty high price for.
Were you shocked by what you saw?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I don't know. I wasn't shocked. If I'd been shocked, I would have liked to have said I would have done something. And I'm guilty of not having done anything. So I don't think I was shocked. And again, I think the desire to be a part of that mission and feeling so connected to the U.S. military and serving in that war, that I accepted on some level that it was going to be unpleasant. And so it was hard, it was very difficult to know what you were supposed to be shocked by, which I know in retrospect sounds hard to believe, but the recognition wasn't that I had done something wrong or illegal. The recognition was that I was a part of something brutal and ugly. It took me a number of years to make that conclusion. It was torture.
Well, I'd like to have you read a section. This is actually the first interrogation that you do.
Sure. So this is not in the hard site at Abu Ghraib. This is in one of the standard interrogation booths. But the next morning, I conduct an interrogation. The detainee is said to be a member of Ansar al-Islam, one of the many umbrella groups that incorporate former Iraqi army soldiers who want to fight coalition forces. They are known to launch mortars into Abu Ghraib. The detainee does not hide his affiliation or his actions. He was caught with mortar rounds. He says the reasons we can't catch them is they drive their mortar teams around on the back of flatbed trucks. As soon as they launch their rounds, they drive to a new location before launching more. He laughs about the incoming rounds from the previous night, and he insists there will be more. This is the first detainee I lay hands on. I grab him by his clothing and drag him out of his chair. He is lighter than I expected, and I shove him into the wall far more violently than I intended. But I am thinking of the mortar attacks, and I am thinking about how scared I am, and I am thinking he deserves this. He does, and it feels good. This is the first interrogation for which I will fill out the paperwork Stefanowicz showed me, and this is the first interrogation where I answer a PIR. And I should say that a PIR is what's known as a priority intelligence requirement, which is what the units would pass down, information that they wanted to know. And in this case, answering the PIR was getting information about who was involved in the mortar attacks on Abu Ghraib.
And Stefanowicz, describe him for us.
So Stefanowicz is well known and has ended up in the media, and I think unfairly so, in terms of he was not the only one involved in these processes, and he was not he was not intentionally breaking laws, and he wasn't some sort of outlaw. Stefanowicz was an interrogator who worked in the hard site, and he had asked. He was the one who had asked me to actually accompany him in the hard site because I spoke Arabic. And seeing the things that I saw in the hard site, things like nudity and forced standing and sleep deprivation, that was really my first introduction to those things. And Stefanowicz, among others, showed me how to fill out the paperwork. So again, these were not things that we were doing and hoping that we weren't going to get caught. We were making records. And Stefanowicz had said, look, don't, you know, had said to me at one point, you know, be creative, don't be stupid. And so the idea was you do these things, but you make a record of them, and you make sure you have approval, and you make sure that when you have done these things that you've written down exactly what took place. So again, there was certainly a great deal of anger and fear associated with these techniques, but there was also there was a program and there was a plan in place.
You had a friend there who also was involved in interrogations, and it seemed that you and he, at least you had somebody there that you could talk to, maybe even confess, if I can use that, some of your guilt, shame about what you were doing or what you saw.
Yeah, so Ferdinand Ababo, who I assume is who we were talking about, he became a very close friend, and he was with me at Abu Ghraib, and then I was eventually transferred to Fallujah, and he went with me to Fallujah as well. And he was, in many ways, a voice of reason. And it wasn't that he was suggesting, hey, we shouldn't be doing these things or we need to tell anyone. But there were things like the hard site. Ferdinand would say, you know, just stay away from the hard site. It's, you know,
don't think about it.
Don't think about it, but also just don't get yourself involved, right? That it's not that we have to report anyone for what's going on, but he even I think he could sense that that was a place that, that we didn't want to go. And then in Fallujah, when we started to run interrogations in Fallujah, they were rough for him as well, meaning that he, I think he was aggressive and certainly used some of these techniques. Again, a recognition that we were doing things that we weren't going to escape. Not suggesting that we were afraid that we were doing something illegal or were going to be prosecuted for, but some things that we knew were for which there would be a consequence. And Ferd was always there to, you know, either sort of make it funny or to suggest that, you know, we need to be thinking about these things.
When you were there, when you were in Iraq, how much did you think about what was going on as much as you have since coming back from Iraq?
Well, we thought about it on a daily basis. I certainly think about it differently now. There were, you know, all interrogators had discussions about what the limits were. And there were discussions, often discussions about a technique that we knew was illegal. You could not threaten a detainee with death. So you couldn't say, if you don't tell me this, I'm going to shoot you. That was clearly a violation. But there were discussions about what could we do, or was it illegal to plant the idea that if a detainee didn't cooperate, that they may die? And one way to do that was to suggest that if you don't cooperate, we're going to send you to Egypt or to the Egyptians, right? And the assumption was—
For rendition or something
right,
like that?
Right, yeah. Well, we weren't— I mean, the Iraqis wouldn't have known that word, but just the idea that— or, even worse, to Israel, right? I mean, or to even Guantanamo Bay. At this point, Guantanamo Bay had a much stronger sort of record for the Iraqis than even Abu Ghraib did. So we would have those discussions. Can we do that and then make the detainee think that they're going to be killed there? And I think the overwhelming answer was no. You know, we can't do that. So there were, as strange as it may seem, there were absolutely discussions and conclusions that there were certain things that we could not be doing.
In this book, you describe something called the Palestinian chair. Yeah. In fact, you tried it out to see, well, what does it feel like to be strapped into the Palestinian chair? First of all, how did it get that name, and how does it work?
Yeah, I was never clear on where the name came from. There were assumptions that that American interrogators and military interrogators had been shown during a joint training exercise with the Israelis. I don't know if any of that's true, and it doesn't matter if any of that's true. It was used by Americans. So people who want to make this connection to suggest that this is something coming from the Israelis, it's ridiculous. These were Americans doing these things. I was doing these things, and I was an American. The Palestinian chair was, it was the first time, so I'd certainly used stress positions at this point, but it was the first time I'd seen a device that was used to put someone into a stress position. And I remember thinking it was strange, but again, not completely out of the ordinary. But Ferdinand and I had discussions about it. And there was a point later in Fallujah in which we thought someone deserved to be put in this chair. And we thought before we did that we should both sit in it and get a sense for what it was. And it forced you into essentially a permanent squat at the lowest point of a squat, and it prevented you from recovering. Your hands were tied back behind your back down to your ankles, and all of your weight was on your hips and your thighs and your calves, and the pain was searing and extraordinarily unpleasant. Now, there's been lots of talk about how people will suggest that they've faced far worse in basic training or football practice. It wasn't the pain that was the torture. It was the knowledge that you couldn't escape and that someone else, and in this case Ferdinand, was holding essentially the keys. And where your mind can take you and the kind of pain that you think you may be faced with or what the rest of your day or week is going to look like, that's how you torture someone.
Did you ever use the Palestinian chair?
I did not. No.
And, for that reason?
Well, you know, this is an area where I'd love to say, look, there's something I did right, there's something I did well, but I'm not going to do that. If I'd been in Fallujah longer, if certain types of prisoners would come in, I don't think there's any reason, or I don't think I have any right to suggest that I wouldn't have. But no, I never did use the chair.
That's Eric Fair, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Grew up and actually lives here in the Lehigh Valley. We've been talking about his time in Iraq. He was a military contractor and interrogator working in both Abu Ghraib and also in a detention facility in Fallujah. And his memoir, Consequence, is about both what he did and the kind of guilt that he has been experiencing for the last 10 years about what he did, what he saw, and what he didn't do as well. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You mentioned Stefanowicz. I mean, you name a lot of names in here. Are these people, in any way, are you outing some of these people, or do we already know this?
No, they're public names. There's actually a suit. Someone is suing Khaki, and the names, to include my name, is in that public record. So no, these I'm not. I did not out anyone. I'm certainly, my intention was never to put anyone in danger or to expose someone's cover. That's not what this book is about. Right. We're not talking about spies here. So. There was a certain – I did not name names in the very beginning when I started writing in 06 and 07. And the relationships that I had with these guys who were close friends ended immediately. They simply kind of broke contact with me and refused to be in touch, and I certainly understood. And I confess that after 10 years, there is a bit of frustration on my part that some of these guys haven't joined me, right? And it's not to suggest that they need to agree with me or that they need to say the exact same things that I'm saying, but they have an obligation to tell these stories. It's clearly something. It's clearly a misstep in American history, and it's clearly there's value to hearing what went on. And if there are people who use these techniques, who use stress positions and sleep deprivation and whatnot, and feel like it was effective, and feel like it's something we should continue to use, and then they need to be out in the public and talking about what they did and how it felt. And if they have no consequence on their own, if they feel fine with what they did, then that's a valuable part of the discussion too. But silence is not. And I'm tired of hearing from voices from people that were not involved in the interrogation program and suggest that they know people who did these things and that these people tell them that I don't want those voices. I want the people who were there, like me. And we, all of us, have to start talking.
You're very honest about how guilty you feel. I don't want to frame, this is going to come out more harsh than I mean it. Mm-hmm. Is it the guilt about what you did or what you didn't do? And by that, I mean didn't do by either stopping someone or sounding the alarm while you were still in Iraq.
I think over the years, so the initial guilt, I think, was some of the things that I had done. And so this becomes a strange kind of thing because there's a part of me that wants to say I did very little in terms. The vast majority of my interrogations were open and honest, and I used my language, and I was effective as an Arabic interrogator. And I just kind of – sort of almost sampled some of these techniques very briefly and was very uncomfortable with them and did not use them. But I have no right to do that. I'm if we're guilty in terms of this being torture, I'm as guilty as anyone. And so I wanted to steer clear of suggesting that I somehow am less guilty than someone else. We're all essentially in this same boat. So, but as time went on, I think it became – I struggled more with the idea that – and certainly when I started writing in 2006 that I had not stopped these things, and I had not gone to someone and said, hey, look, this is beneath us, and we shouldn't be doing it.
You do describe, in a sense, sort of using the sounds of people screaming as a way of softening up someone that you might be wanting to interrogate.
Yeah, so the interrogation booth at Abu Ghraib in particular was just a plywood structure, and you could hear what went on in all the other booths. And so some of the very aggressive – and there was a technique called fear up harsh – which was essentially to scare someone as much as you possibly could, and that was often done with lots of yelling and screaming. And the mind can do terrible things to you, and so you hear these things and you don't see them. You're not quite sure what's going on. And so rather than doing what I should have done, which is gone next door and made sure that it stopped, or I would leave the prisoner in the room by himself, and I would allow his mind to essentially drift. And that way, I didn't have to do any of the dirty work myself. It was being done by my colleagues in other rooms.
You wrote recently, this is in the New York Times actually earlier this year, You wrote, I did not waterboard anyone in Iraq. I like to think that's a line I would never cross, but I have no right to think that way. My behavior in Iraq forces me to confess that if I'd been asked to waterboard someone at Abu Ghraib in early 2004, I most likely would not have hesitated. I mean, that's a powerful thing to say.
And I don't want to own that. You know, even now, I there's a huge part of me that just screams that, you know, you would not have waterboarded anyone. I was not exposed to waterboarding in any way. I'm not even sure that I'd heard of it at that point, or certainly not thought about it. So, yeah, even right sitting here right now, I want to say, no, of course I wouldn't have waterboarded anyone. But there's no value in that discussion, and I think Americans have to be careful about kind of drawing these lines. Well, as long as we don't waterboard, then we're not torturing. Certainly, years of perspective have made me recognize how ludicrous that statement is. I mean, if that's our line, if we're essentially saying, look, as long as we don't waterboard anyone, or as long as we don't cause organ failure, or as long as we don't kill anyone, you know, I hope that's not who we've become.
I mean, is that the slippery slope that people talk about?
Sure. I think that's certainly the easiest way to describe it. But again, we should not be talking about what we might be allowed to do, or how we can be creative. We need to talk about who we are as a nation, things like the Constitution, and recognize that those values are things that we need to – I mean, I thought that was the whole point. I thought we were spreading these values. And so we should be over there saying, you know, yes, we'll take prisoners of war, but when we do, we will care for them. And we may not get the information that we want, but that's not what matters. What matters is that we lead essentially by example. I mean, and that's really where that's the strength that this country has, is the example that we set. And my suspicion, again, is that if we did do it that way and we did care for these prisoners of war, that we'd gather far more intelligence than we have from places like Guantanamo Bay or Abu Ghraib or Camp Buka or wherever it is.
That's Eric Fair, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And he's got a memoir. It's called Consequence. And again, as you've been hearing, talking about what he did and didn't do when he was an interrogator in Iraq, working at both Abu Ghraib and a site in Fallujah in Iraq. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Eric Fair about his memoir called Consequence. You write in here, my Sudanese translator struggles to understand my English. The detainee struggles to understand the dialect of the translator. The translator struggles to understand the Arabic of the detainee. I struggle to understand the English of the translator. Takes nearly 2 hours to collect enough information to write a report that says detainee doesn't seem to understand questions about chemical weapons. I mean, obviously, the language problems, yeah. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to get this information, but all the hurdles that you have to try to overcome to get there.
Yeah, so I think there's this image in America of interrogations being these incredibly deep, complicated discussions, and the vast majority of them are not. They're very difficult, awkward conversations, and with translators in particular. I mean, there's so many different dialects in Arabic, and then so many different levels of Arabic speakers, whether you're speaking to a farmer from Anbar province or someone from central Baghdad. I mean, so many of the interrogations were just essentially a waste of time. I mean, 45 minutes to an hour just to establish real basic background information. Getting something as simple as a home address could take the entire interrogation. And not because they were being deceptive, but because there are just different ways of, you know, we think, oh, here's my home address, the city post office box. But it didn't work that way in parts of Iraq.
You describe an interrogation when there was a young boy and an older man together. That seemed to be a low point for
you.
Yeah,
that was one of my last in Fallujah, actually. And at this point, Ferdinand and I had long discussions about these techniques, and we had both essentially moved away from them. And all of our interrogations at this point were direct. My Arabic had improved dramatically, and so I could hold conversations essentially on my own. Occasionally, subject would get complicated enough that I'd use a translator. But this was one of the final interrogations, and I think I was tired. And it was a prisoner that had come in, a young boy, and had also been brought in with an older man and some other people who clearly knew information about an extraordinarily dangerous intersection in Fallujah, in which American soldiers had been killed, and attacks were really common. And I think they had lived nearby and had been captured with some equipment. So we knew that they they had some kind of information. And it was critical to get this stuff because, you know, we had – I mean, American troops had to drive around. And so he simply denied knowing anything about the intersection or anything that was going on. And at that point, I should have just let him go. And, or not let him go, but I should have just ended the interrogation and moved on. I mean, he was essentially being courageous for lying to an American interrogator. But I got frustrated. And I remember I ripped the chair out from underneath him, and he fell to the floor. And when he did, the old man, who I had essentially forgotten was in the room with me, kind of approached, and I shoved him back, and he whacked his head on the wall. And the thump is something I still, even today, I can hear it and kind of feel it. So yeah, it was that, you know, was there a low point in Iraq? I don't know. I mean, the whole thing was just low. So but I remember it well.
You have had nightmares. Do you still have nightmares about Iraq?
I will tonight. I mean,
you will,
yeah,
because,
I mean,
you're
right. The discussion,
we're stirring things up here.
Certainly, time. You know, I didn't want to hear that that time heals all wounds. You know, a year or two after I'd gotten out, because things were still so intense. But there's no denying that that certainly we're able to fill it with new memories and new thoughts. But something a trauma like war, and there are certainly other traumas similar to this. It doesn't have a place to fit in your memory. It's in some ways like an open filing cabinet, and you can't get it shut all the way. And it's always right there, and there's no way to put it away.
I'm sure some people listening to us would say, I would never do that. I would never cross that line. And I remember saying this to you back in 2008, where I made the assumption that you're a good person. I think you were at Princeton Theological Seminary at the time. So I thought that was some indication that this was a person who was interested in morality and goodness and perhaps badness. But what you're saying is that even a quote-unquote good person can do some of these things that in this case are torture.
Yeah, well, there were no bad people. And I mean, there were a few people who I didn't like to work with and some people who annoyed me, like any office environment. But I worked with really good people. And CACI, which has taken a lot of flack and maybe rightfully so, hired good people, many unqualified and in positions that maybe they shouldn't have been. But again, this is a large-scale interrogation in the Middle East, which we'd not done before. Essentially, all of us were unqualified. So, yeah, I know people – it's easier to think that this is done by evil people and people that were, you know, mean to animals when they were kids. But it's simply not true. It was done by well-meaning Americans who wanted to serve. And you can certainly have long arguments about whether or not the war should have been fought. But when we were there in 2004 and 5, we thought that we were doing the right thing. And we were surrounded by other people who agreed with us.
And is that part of the problem in that you're in a world where everyone is, in a sense, working out of the same playbook?
Yeah. You know, I've made some comments in the past about how I wish in some ways there had been more Democrats at Abu Ghraib. And so I often speak to groups, and often progressive groups.
You mean like Democrats?
Democrats as in Democrats and Republicans, right? More liberals, more progressives. And I consider myself a liberal and a progressive. But there's clearly an issue in the United States about the separation between the military and its civilian populace. But within that argument is another one about the separation of more progressively minded people and liberals from the military. I often speak on college campuses, and I'll ask the college students, you know, how many have considered joining the military, or no one. And it's almost laughable. And the idea that, you know, their parents would kill them. And that's a sad, sad state. And so I'm loath to make excuses for what I did, and I'm not trying to do that here, but I think there are explanations that we need to explore. And if it's so easy for my progressive-minded audiences to suggest that I should have known better, then it would have been nice to have some of those people in leadership positions at places like Abu Ghraib and Fallujah telling us that we should have known better. And maybe that's a little bit too simplistic. Mm-hmm. But I think there is an argument to be made that when we separate our military from the actual makeup of the American public, and that when we don't have a good representation of who we are as a nation, that we get ourselves into trouble.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from Tommy says, I don't remember if you've ever been critical of those in power in America at the time leading up to the events that you discussed. I mean, as you said, you supported the war. This was after 9/11.
I did, yeah. I've not been – that's not what this project is about. There are plenty of books and articles and TV programs about what happened in 2003, 2004 and the run-up to the war. And I certainly have my opinions, and I think some of them come across pretty clearly. But yeah, post 9/11, I did support the invasion of Iraq, and I had reason to believe that someone like Colin Powell was being honest.
Was at the UN?
At the UN, yeah, when he held up the vial and said that they have chemical weapons. And I may not have agreed or even necessarily liked Dick Cheney, but he was the vice president of the United States, and I had no reason to believe that he'd go on air publicly and say things And I'm not even now convinced, and to me it doesn't matter whether they were lying or just wrong. That really has nothing to do with, I think, the narrative of something like torture.
A tweet from Kay saying, why isn't the guest serving time for his misdeeds?
Well, you know, as a police officer, I would pull people over for blowing through a stop sign or getting into a car accident because they didn't use their turn signal. I did not ask them if they thought that they should be prosecuted before I wrote them a ticket. You know, it was my job as a policeman to be that part of the judicial system. It's not. I would hope that a prosecutor would not come to me and ask, you know, do you think you deserve to be prosecuted? Because I would absolutely say no. I'm a human being. I'd rather not be prosecuted. But certainly that can't make. I can't play any role in that process. Now, if a close friend of mine came to me and said, hey, you know, I'm trying not to get prosecuted, but I'm not sure if I did something illegal, I would say, well, you probably shouldn't write a book about it, and you probably should just keep your mouth shut. So I'm aware of what I'm doing here, and I'm aware of what I'm saying, and I'm aware of how the world works.
Well, as you mentioned, there is a suit against CACI, C-A-C-I,
there is, yeah.
And you're named in that.
Yeah, I am. And it's, you know, that's nothing I can control. That's beyond, and it really has nothing to do with why I wrote this book. I didn't write the book because I'm named, and I wouldn't have not written the book if I wasn't. I mean, it doesn't play a part in this.
Is part of the issue that what you did and what others did, maybe even including waterboarding, was legal, was sanctioned at the time?
It was legal, yeah. And the idea that, again, you know, the narrative has gone in so many different strange directions. The idea that this organization, this contracting company, CACI, somehow got civilians into Iraq and misled the army, and, you know, the soldiers were all sort of good people and we were the bad. You know, that's that same narrative, that we're just desperate to make this about something else and someone else, and to refuse to find a way to suggest that this was an American issue, and it was not done behind closed doors, and it was policy.
You write about coming back to the U.S., coming back to this region, and having drinking problems, stresses in the marriage.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I don't know. I'm happy with the book, and I think it tells an honest story. But there are certain things that I may not have addressed in the same way. And I think alcohol is one of those, because what I don't want to do is paint a picture that suggests that all veterans come home and become alcoholics. And I think I certainly abused alcohol in some ways and in some necessary ways just to sort of survive what was happening. But I don't want to turn this into it's not an addiction memoir. It's not a narrative about alcoholics. I think those are critical issues that veterans and civilians need to talk about. But that, again, I don't want to distract from really what was my core issue, which is torture.
You had to have a heart transplant.
I did, yeah.
I mean, does this have any – I know this was a problem even before you went to Iraq.
Yeah, well –
but does it tell us something about a broken heart?
You know, when we were talking about the title for the book, it was hard not to sort of think about that narrative. You know, a change of heart would have been – you know, which just – it was – but – and that none of that was really true. I mean, when I spoke to you in 2008, I was incredibly sick and incredibly ill, and I certainly wasn't talking about it publicly. But, you know, I dropped out of Princeton later that year and went home. And within a year or two, I ended up on my deathbed. I mean, I couldn't breathe. But by that point, I'd written the articles and I'd done the interviews. And so certainly it's going to affect the way I move forward, but it had very little to do with the decision to go public with this stuff.
We have, looks like, a Mrs. J joining our conversation. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. Yes, Eric, I just wanted to thank you for the things that you've said. And I'm wondering how you interpret what happened, knowing that after just about a year and a half ago, after all of the terrorism acts had occurred, the representative of the Psychological Society had come forward to announce regrets that the body of the psychologists had signed on to those very techniques about the types of interrogation methods that you discussed, including preventing people from sleeping for 8 days, and that those techniques are used against the general public even today.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. In fact, we did a program about that with, I believe, the head of the APA at the time, talking about, and this is the SEER program.
Sure, yeah.
And the psychologist, yeah. Jensen and...
Mitchell and Jessen.
Mitchell, yeah. And Jessen,
yeah.
Yes. They
were two former Air Force, I think, lieutenant colonels who had been part of the program. Yeah, I was actually involved briefly with the APA up in Boston, and I think it was in 2008. and was on a panel. And this is the point at which the APA was kind of having this internal debate about whether or not they should be involved. And so I went up and spoke sort of in support of those who said that they shouldn't. There was a psychologist at Abu Ghraib who did work with us. And again, his intention was not – it wasn't as if we arrived and were surprised to see this. He was there in some ways to care for the prisoners but also the interrogators. But, yeah, he absolutely came to us and said, you know, if there are ways that I can help and if there are ways that I, you know, you can sort of use my skills. Now, it wasn't entirely clear what that meant. But, yeah, again, there were so many things at places like Abu Ghraib and in Iraq in general that just didn't seem to make sense that you somehow just kind of moved forward and accepted it. So I think it's a really important discussion that the APA needs to continue to have to include the entire medical community about what their role should be in interrogations. And clearly they should be there to make sure that that prisoners of war are kept safe.
Thanks for the call. I'm going to get Steve from Newtown to join our conversation. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Eric for coming forth with and speaking honestly about a really needed subject, especially in light of Trump's remarks last month about trashing the Geneva Convention. I spent 24 years active duty, 30 years in the military to count my reserve time, and a trip to Afghanistan. And at the end of my career, I became very disturbed once I heard about waterboarding being accepted. I couldn't see how any reasonable person could think that was not torture. And one other thing I wanted to share with Eric is, in my retirement ceremony from the military, I made sure I put in there that my mother, who was in the audience, who was a World War II combat nurse, I said she had to reassure her Nazi patients that her hypodermic needles did not contain poison. I said that didn't represent the weakness of America. That represented the greatness of America.
That's powerful, Steve. I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Eric, you want to say anything in response?
Yeah. Again, you know, I there's still a huge part of me that wants to go back and suggest that as someone who wore the uniform, that I too would have seen something like waterboarding and stopped it, or at least said something. And there are lots of people, and maybe even a majority of those who serve, if not all of them, who know that this kind of thing now, certainly in retrospect, was wrong and continues to be wrong, that it doesn't represent, you know, all those values that I spent all those years in uniform representing. You know, we had, you probably had the same thing, the little card that you carried around in your wallet that you know, had the Army values and, you know, honor, duty, courage and integrity. And it was, you know, it was hard when we were there to question the Army because we had such love for it. But certainly moving forward, as I thought about some of those same values that the military instilled in me, it's those values that eventually sort of forced me to speak out. So, I'm not in any way critical of the Army. I still have great love for that institution, and I still think it's you know, in some ways it's responsible for putting me in Iraq, but it's also responsible for if there's any good that comes out of this book, I think it's because of the values that I picked up in uniform.
Steve, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Eric, we're almost out of time here. You do come from a long line of Presbyterians who have fought in wars. Yeah. What, four generations?
I mean, just about every war that America has been involved in, there's a, you know, a Campbell or a Byrd or a Fair or someone in uniform there, to include places like Gettysburg and, you know, even the American Revolution. So my father did not serve. He received deferments for Vietnam, and he's had discussions with me, and I'm sure he's listening right now, but that, you know, there's a certain, almost some regret that he didn't serve during those times. And I'm thrilled that he didn't, because knowing what I know now. But yeah, it's a part of who I am.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book as
well. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Eric Fair, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and his memoir is titled, very simply, Consequence. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Abby Sarfo, our intern for today's edition of the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.